Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to another episode of the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Now, on today's episode, we have got on a filmmaker. He has recently been working on a project called The Woke Reformation, and this is Travis Brown. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Zuby. Thanks so much for having me on.
How are you? Travis? Yeah, I'm doing great, man. Always doing great. So yeah. I've done a brief intro there, man, but tell people who you are and a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. So as you said, I'm Travis Brown. I'm currently living in Oregon. I've lived there for about 17 years or so. It's kind of, at least Portland is one of the woke capitals of the world. So it's been interesting making this series while, living kind of in the epicenter of all this stuff. It made me move from where I was living pretty close to downtown Portland when the riots kicked off in 2020. And maybe this is something we can get into, but I was disabled for a long time, for years, because I had crippling pain in my back and I was pretty much living in my bed. But I was still committed to making films and I really wanted to make something on the sort of woke explosion that was happening all around us, especially me. And then there were just people parking on my street with protest signs and helicopters over my, apartment, and just, people took over the bridge and then they started taking over downtown and it was just insane. And Antifa was everywhere. And so I moved right before I released this series to a kind of a safer place. I made the series in large part because I had lived in Portland for quite a while, and there was something akin to what I had grown up with. I grew up in a fundamentalist religious home. It was very strict, very ultra conservative, and just very restrictive, and a lot of black and white thinking, a lot of fundamentalist thinking. And I started to see kind of the same mentality, just in a different set of beliefs, but the same mentality in group, out group thinking, demonizing anyone who doesn't agree, in Portland and in Seattle, where I lived as well. And I just saw a very kind of religious nature to this ideology that was unfolding in the streets as well as online and just in my interpersonal relationships. And I really wanted to document what was going on. And I was, had been friends with Peter Boghossian for a while and filmed him and James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose when they came through Portland. And so I was kind of aware of, some of the origins of these ideas, what would be called critical social justice. They just spurred me on to make a series about it.
I hear that. What's the timeline of when you started to notice the rise of what you would call the woke ideology?
I didn't call it the same thing back then, but it was probably like, it certainly took off when Trump was running and then elected. But even before that, I just noticed a lot of the same, as I mentioned before, just the same kind of like fundamentalist thinking, like, oh, if you don't agree with us, you must be bad. All the Republicans, they're evil. I don't really consider myself a Republican or a Democrat. I'm just somewhere in the middle. I just don't really prefer the labels. I just noticed there was a, it was hard to deviate from the party line. And this is probably back in, I noticed it as early as 2012. There was like the Wall Street protests, a little before that. And it was really around then that I started to notice that way of thinking, that kind of dogmatic thinking. And then it just got worse and worse. And then when Trump was elected, it got way worse. And there were riots and, arson and things in the street, even back in 2016, 2017, before 2020. So it just kind of elevated and rose and rose and rose. And I had the idea to make the series back in 2019. But then I got funding in, I think it was late 2020. So that's when I started to start writing and start filming and everything.
I hear that. And I think when we're talking about these ideas and ideologies, my listeners will certainly be familiar with them for the most part. But I know you talk about this in your, would you call it a series or a documentary, The Woke Reformation?
Yeah, docuseries, yeah.
Docuseries, okay. In that you go into the history of some of these ideas, because we're talking about stuff happening in the last decade. A lot of people, if you live in the modern Western world, particularly the Anglosphere, it's the past decade where this stuff has really gotten weird and come off the hinges. I tend to say it's really kicked off in the mainstream in 2012 and then accelerated very heavily in 2015. You talk about the origins of this, because I think the average person doesn't realize, even the people who advocate these causes, oftentimes don't realize how many decades these ideas actually go back in terms of their sort of foundations.
Right.
So can you give people an overview of, number one, what does woke even mean in the way that people understand it now? But what's the origin of these ideas? Where did these ideas come from?
Sure. It is the point that you made about people not necessarily knowing where these ideas have come from, and they've just absorbed them and then proliferate them, is really fascinating. I mean, it's sort of like being a good Muslim or a good Christian, but not having really read the Bible or the Quran, and just espousing the ideas that, you know, a person's church or mosque or whatever tells them. Although in this case, there is no central place that people go and learn this, except I guess, except for the university and now social media. So it's interesting. This religion, if you want to call it that, is much more disorganized, and there is not quite the same kind of hierarchy that you see in traditional religions. But you do have this kind of priestly class of people like Judith Butler and Ibram X. Kendi, and then before that, you have people like, you know, Herbert Marcuse, who's a neo-Marxist. You have the postmodernists that heavily, I mean, their ideas are everywhere in terms of being really the foundation for this stuff. But just to pick up on, you asked what woke means. I mean, it originally just meant to be awakened to injustice. I mean, it was, came from Black American culture, this idea of being woke or awakened to racial injustice. But it's sort of spread to mean being awakened to any kind of prejudice or any kind of societal injustice, systemic injustice. And, you know, some people still occasionally use that. I actually saw on Twitter the other day, someone was using that to refer to themselves. And nowadays it's usually more used often by conservatives as, you know, a jab, like, oh, you know, these people are woke, and it has a much more negative connotation, but some people still do use it in the original sense. Now, unfortunately, it's often just conflated with anything that's not conservative. Anything that's liberal or progressive is woke, which I wouldn't really agree with. I think there's, for me, it's a particular strain of thought that's based on largely neo-Marxism mixed with postmodernism. And the postmodern concepts are really ideas like, you know, language creates our reality. That's where we get these ideas of like my truth and your truth, and this subjective vision of the truth where anyone can have, you know, that's where this idea of lived experience comes from, which is kind of a weird, redundant phrase if you think about it. But it just gives power to the idea of a personal anecdote or, you know, personal experience. But, you know, the postmodernists were heavily interested in language and how language can affect the way we think. And some of them even went so far as to say the language creates the reality that we interact with. And so there are a lot of people like Kimberly Crenshaw in the 80s and 90s that took aspects of postmodernism and then infused them with this more social justice activism in the universities. And then again, there are strains of neo-Marxism because now it's no longer so much about class, a class struggle. It's really more about these identity groups that are clashing and struggling. And the more marginalized the identity category that you happen to be in, the more you happen to be oppressed. So it still takes that key Marxist concept of the oppressor versus the oppressed, but it changes it from class to identity, any kind of identity that you can think of, whether it's a disabled person, a fat, fat person who's very overweight and healthy, or a black person or person with dark skin color, or whatever possible identity people can use to say is oppressed or marginalized. That's really kind of used almost as a battering ram against the system, the capitalist system. So it's really interesting when you start learning about this stuff and you start seeing the same kind of language all over the place. And it always comes down to like a hatred of capitalism. And then they use, justice with everything, environmental justice, climate justice. It's amazing. And it's kind of funny, really.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting when, like I said, given the fact that I know for sure that the majority of people espousing these ideas have not, read Foucault or Derrida or perhaps even Alinsky or Marcuse, all the people who have even the, a lot of them probably haven't even read Kimberlé Crenshaw and this and this. And it's fascinating. I find it interesting when people repeat certain words and phrases and terminology and ideas, despite the fact that they don't even know where they came from. That's something that I find really fascinating because you really see it. There's certain, you've mentioned a few of them, and there's certain words or phrases, and when someone uses them, let alone uses them in combination, it's like, okay, I know what I'm dealing with here. I'm hearing his truth, her truth, my truth. Live my lived experience, patriarchy, white supremacy, people of color this, BIPOC that. Like, as soon as I hear all the more of that terminology I hear, I'm just like, oh gosh, okay, I'm dealing with someone who is not thinking. They're just repeating, they're repeating the script. And it's also interesting because they themselves don't even question if some of those terms make sense. For example, you said lived experience, right? The lived is totally redundant. Right? So if someone even uses that term, I'm like, why are you saying like you, I'm like, you learned that from somewhere. Because no one, I remember the world prior to 2010, and I never used to hear the term lived experience. Now I hear it all the time,
For
right?
sure.
I never used to see the term BIPOC or Latinx. Or even growing up, even growing up, I never heard the term people of color, POC, let alone an abbreviation of it, right? No one. And so this terminology, like I said, it's existed for a while, but it's been mainstreamed in this past decade. And people are just kind of repeating and repeating and repeating these phrases. And I'm like, do you even know what that, do you know what that means? Do you know where that comes from? Have you taken a moment to go, okay, wait, hang on. Does this really make sense? And do I have this idea or does this idea have me?
For sure. And they're often, if you do poke and prod and ask them questions, they're often, not always, but often really fragile and don't want to have conversations about that. They haven't thought about the epistemology or how they know what they know. It's just they've just absorbed it. And there's an interesting key mechanism to deflect any kind of inquiry, epistemological inquiry or questioning, which is, well, that and rationality and the scientific method and objectivity are all, white male Western constructs. So we don't engage in that. I mean, it's an amazing hermetically sealed, enclosed bubble of a worldview that just cannot be, you just can't really get through it unless someone's actually willing to have a conversation and actually willing to put aside some of the absurdities. But, unfortunately, often they aren't.
Yeah, there's a deep level of intolerance that comes with it, which is another part of the thing that's very fascinating. I'm amazed by the constant inversions of everything, right? So the people who are claiming to be love diversity and promote diversity, but actually they hate any type of ideological or belief system diversity. They claim to be pro inclusion. You'll never find a more exclusive group, exclusive group of people. They claim to be tolerant, but they're deeply intolerant to the point of being willing to use and advocate and condone physical violence against people. They'll say that words are violence, but violence itself is not violence. It's like they just invert, they've inverted everything. And that's the part that I find. I mean, I know that a lot of people do see through it. Most people are not on board with all of this stuff to the degree that activists are. But I think what's it's interesting because in a way, if I kind of like tap into my dark side, I can understand how these ideas are kind of like appealing in a way. because I think they play a lot on human envy and resentment and jealousy and tribalism. But it's also really goofy. Like there's this silliness. There's a silliness to it all. Like the whole thing would be extraordinarily funny if it were not so destructive and divisive. You kind of see what I mean? Like some of the ideas, I'm just like, come on, man. Like, what do you mean math is racist? Like, math is racist. Like, stop. You know, it's silly.
Healthy at every size.
Yeah, it's goofy. They're very silly ideas. They're not like well thought through ideas of like, oh, actually, okay, yeah, I can, you know, maybe some elements of it, but maybe they've kind of just jumped the shark at this point and they've taken it to a really silly level.
Yeah. I know you mentioned not too long ago something about being past peak woke, and I hope that you're right. I hope that's true. I think you're right that, you know, most people don't believe to the same level that activists do. But what I find still disturbing is how many of these ideas have proliferated and how many, like you said before, like how many people say the words lived experience or how many people use certain concepts and ideas from this ideology without realizing it and maybe without having bought into it entirely. But it's been so successful in spreading through universities and through the media and now through the government, et cetera, through K-12 even, that so many people adopt at least one or two of these ideas or several of these ideas without even realizing it, without being cognizant that of the fact that they're doing that. And so I think to uproot that and to really like shed, it's just a lot of layers to shed, and I think it will take time to do that if it ever really happens. They've just been so good at manipulating words. Some of their ideas are crazy and silly and are easier to reject, but some of them, like, you know, I mean, we all know what Antifa is like, but that idea has so much weight behind it for so many people still. This idea that, oh, well, Antifa just means anti-fascist, you know, Black Lives Matter just means that Black Lives Matter, right? Like the way that they have constructed these words and even lived experience, like that, it just sounds heavier, like weightier. It sounds more important than personal anecdote, you know? And so they've been able to construct a lexicon that has fooled a lot of people and still fools people, unfortunately. But that's one of the things that I'm trying to do in the series is just help people understand, like, these ideas aren't what they claim them to be, like diversity, like inclusion, like all of these things. They often mean the opposite. Yes. And so I think it's important to educate people about that, you know, hopefully in an entertaining way that it sticks with them and they can tell other people and these ideas can spread and people can then start to counter them. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think there's the understanding component. First of all, I think the biggest barrier, I talk about it all the time. I do genuinely think that the biggest barrier is fear. It's fear. People are afraid. Most people are pretty sane. You know, most people are not extremists of either end. Most people are not radical. Most people kind of want pretty normal, sane stuff in the world, whether you consider yourself centrist or right leaning or left leaning, conservative, liberal, whatever. Like 95% of people are just somewhere in that central ish way, you know? And I think that the problem is that the sane center and the sane left and the sane right, if you even want to use these terms, most people are afraid. Most people are afraid. I think a lot of the power of the activist types and the people who are like, you know, the small percentage who are real diehard for this ideology is that they've managed to browbeat people, right? They've managed to frighten so many people who actually do have questions about it or are not in favor of it or directly oppose it or whatever. But because they have these weapons of the isms and the phobias, right? Calling people racist, sexist, white supremacist, homophobic, transphobic, whatever. The average person does not want to be, no one wants to be called those things, but the average person is very hurt and gets very defensive when being called those things, perhaps not realizing that these are just being used as weapons, right? They're not, these are not genuine accusations of someone really believing that you're a hateful bigot or you're truly a Nazi or you're truly a fascist. How many Nazis and fascists are out there? How many fascists have you really met in your life? You know what I mean? Like these are not, but they're these sort of straw men. But I think that most people are just working their jobs and whatever. They're not trying to deal with all this mess. And You know, one of the worst things you can be called in us in our society is, you know, a racist, right? Like that's one. Yeah. It's a serious charge. Maybe it wouldn't have been 100 years ago. It's almost like as a result of the progress that's been made, some of these things can be weaponized more, right? The thing I find really insidious about it, and why I find these, you know, a lot of these activists, a lot of people think that a lot of these activists are acting in good faith, and that they genuinely, I don't buy it. I'm not talking about the average person who's just kind of gone to college or whatever and has soaked some of this stuff up, but the people who are out there on the streets, the people who are screaming at people and fighting and what, I do not think these people are driven by, I don't think they're driven by good motives at all. I've interacted with enough of them to be like, no, like, you know, if you're willing to beat people in the street, or you're willing to like just scream and cuss, like, no, you're not sure. A good guy in this situation. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I think often you're right. I think it's complex. So, you know, if you look at like the profiles of some of the people that were on the street and were causing mayhem and hurting people, like many of them are mentally ill, you know, and groups like Antifa, many of them are mentally ill. And so, you know, I think it's complex. Like, I think there are some true believers who really have been brainwashed, who think they're really fighting actual fascists. Like, they really think that, and they're really, you know, willing to use violence because, you know, I mean, that's what we had to do in World War II, right? So there are those people who actually believe that. Then there are the more cynical people who just hate capitalism, or they're just bummed about their life because they're just not successful in any way, and they go into the street and they just take it out on other people. And then, you know, you have a mixture of people who are mentally ill and or drug addicted or whatever. It was really interesting to see how many like homeless people have been kind of corralled into this cause, you know, especially in Portland. So it's a really odd and interesting, chaotic mixture of people. But you're right. There are many people who are just out to cause chaos and mayhem, mm-hmm. you know, and cause harm. But I definitely think it's a mixture.
Yeah, I think there is a mix. But even with that first category, I have certain heuristics. And, you know, one of my heuristics is that, if you're willing to use violence against peaceful people, you're the bad guy.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, if you've got your belief or whatever, but no matter, like, I have some beliefs that are, you know, very, you know, strong and firm, and I believe this thing, but there's a line, like, I would not use nor condone physical violence, hurting, beating, killing someone.
Right.
Because I think I'm right and they're wrong. Like we're not talking self-defense. We're not talking, oh, someone hits you, you hit them back. We're talking, okay, sure. Someone is just there with an idea in their head, whether they truly believe it or not.
Right.
Even if, and this is the truth, right? Even if someone actually were a Nazi, someone actually had that belief system.
Right.
If they are not out there, you know, hurting people or whatever, they just have this thing in their head. Like they're truly, truly racist, right? But it's just in their head. No, you don't have a right to go and assault them.
Right.
Right? Someone's going to take this, you know, Zuby defends Nazis or whatever. But like, if people are allowed to have bad thoughts, like people are allowed to actually believe bad things. If you act on it and you go out there and you do that, that's a different story, right? That's when people can, you know, defend themselves. But if someone's just like, oh, that person is standing there, but he has bad thoughts in his head.
Right.
Okay. So that means it's okay to assault him. It's like, no, that's an assault. Like you're the one who's taking that line. So when I see people who are willing to do that and condone that, I'm just like, all right, well, you know, you may believe what you believe and truly believe it, but you know, you're the bad guy in this situation.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember as much as I disliked, perhaps even loathe Richard Spencer, I remember being pretty concerned about someone just punching him in the back of the head when he was giving an interview. And then not so much just that, but then the reaction to it, especially from a lot of people I know who say, well, he's a Nazi. You know, we all punch Nazis. That's the thing that we do. And we were all, you know, those of us concerned about this are thinking, well, you can call anyone a Nazi. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then Andy Ngo got attacked, right? Andy Ngo is a Nazi, really? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and that word is just, that word is just thrown around to attach to anyone you don't like. And then you can just use violence against them. So it is a slippery slope, as a lot of us warned back then. And it's very disturbing. It's it's really concerning that people are willing to go to that length.
What's it like? What's Portland actually like? It's actually one of the, I've been to a lot of the US, but I haven't actually been to Portland before. It's one of those places where honestly, my view of it is probably very biased and tainted, just because every time I hear about it, it's the crazy stuff. It's never, you know, something sane and positive. What's it actually like there, and how's it changed perhaps even in the time you've been there?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been there for, like I said, over a decade and a half. It was lovely. You know, people were really nice to each other and lots of great food. I mean, great hiking, a lot of outdoor spaces and, you know, a lot of artists, a lot of that sort of thing. But I think slowly people's sense of morality got hijacked, and more and more people started to be on board with more and more radical ideas. I mean, something close to a third of the populace wanted to defund the police, and they did. They removed $14 million from the police, and they got rid of the gun violence reduction team. Guess what happened? Gun violence went up. Mm-hmm. Wow. Who could have fucking guessed that? You know, it's maddening. You know, it's maddening. I moved out of the city to a much quieter, safer neighborhood. And whenever I go into Portland, I still see homeless encampments, you know, all over the place. It's just really gone downhill. They've tried to clean up downtown a bit. But you know, they still find any reason they can to riot Antifa and those types of people. Mm-hmm. You know, like when the abortion act happened, or when someone gets murdered by police or killed by the police or whatever in a different city, they always find a reason to cause mayhem. And you know, just in general, the city infrastructure, the leaders are terrible. It's just, and now, like, I feel uncomfortable just walking around the city. I just don't. Part, you know, you see people shooting up, that's part of it. You see people, you know, homeless people everywhere, but then also just the people in general. I mean, just knowing that a third of the people wanted to defund the police, and there were, you know, thousands of people in the streets marching. Some of them obviously came from Seattle and other places, but still, so many people were either joined in doing it, or condoned it, or were quiet and didn't speak out against it. Or didn't even, like, there are people that live in Portland that still don't know, like, how bad it got. And they thought it was only, you know, a block or two downtown that was destroyed, which is just not true. I mean, they were all over the place. So, you know, some of the stories are certainly true. I'll say that. Yeah.
Well, but what changed? I mean, I'm assuming you moved there in the mid thousands, maybe 2005-ish, yeah, something like that. So I don't know when I think of 2005, it doesn't seem that long ago. Like, what changed? Yeah. So what was the catalyst of this change in this under 20-year span, which has caused millions of people to, you know, or even for a city that was previously pleasant? I hear people say the same thing about places like San Francisco, Seattle. Like, what is it? I don't know. It's interestingly, these are all on the West Coast, but what, I don't know, what is it that changed? I'm also asking curiously as a non-American, as a British guy, like, what is it that changed so drastically that caused that?
I think there were always kind of the seeds of this in the more progressive cities, in the more liberal cities that are much more tolerant of new experimental ideas. I think it's much easier. I think Douglas Murray has talked about this, that conservatives have more of a natural bulwark against new ideas that could be harmful. So that's a key part of it. You know, part of what changed is, you know, the proliferation of the iPhone and social media. And I think that's a huge part of it. I think that's a huge part of allowing these ideas that were germinating in universities and in sort of more obscure academic circles with, you know, Herbert Marcuse and Michel Foucault and all these people. Like, those ideas were out there, and you can find, you know, in the early 2000s, in the 90s, you can find people talking about, you know, systemic racism and lived experience and all these things that are now everywhere. They were much more obscure then, and in part, those ideas have spread because of social media and these people getting these platforms that then, you know, push that out everywhere. And another interesting thing, again, it has to do with the smartphone, is that anywhere anyone can be a reporter. They can now film any injustice. So anywhere in the world can do this, and anywhere in the world can see it. And so even though, you know, as Steven Pinker and Hans Rosling and other people have shown, you know, violence has declined and we've progressed in so many ways. But if people had cell phones and social media, let's say 100 years ago, it would have been utter mayhem. Like, the internet would have been insane to see how violent people were and how horrible things were. But now that we can see that, we can see one instance of that, and our moral sensitivity, I think, is heightened. So we're just aghast whenever we see any terrible thing, as we should be. I think that's understandable. But we have what I think Pinker called a false sense of insecurity. And because of that, we think that well, you know, thousands of unarmed Black people are being killed by the police, and, you know, anyone who's lesbian or gay is being attacked or killed, or, you know, anyone who's trans is being killed every day. You know, and we get these deranged statistics in part because we have kind of a mismatch from what's actually happening for the day-to-day person and then what we see online. So that really, I think, skews our perspective. And in part as a result, you know, people are up in arms about it. You know, they want to do something. They want to solve the problem because they think it's everywhere and it's just so bad. And they don't stop to think about, like, well, how often actually does it happen? They don't stop to read the FBI statistics or, you know, the Washington Post statistics of how many unarmed people are actually killed by the police. And are they really unarmed, or are they driving a car into a cop or stealing a cop's gun and they're classified as unarmed? So there's just a lot of information that people don't have. And I think their view of reality just gets drastically skewed, and they end up in the street, you know, marching or rioting or whatever.
Yeah, I think you're totally right on that. And it's interesting. Like, I get it. And maybe this is my personality type. Like, I'm not that sympathetic towards it because I think past a point, ignorance is a choice, right? Especially in this day and age. I mean, not you know, 100 years ago, getting access to certain information or stats or data, like, it was hard. But, like, you're literally, and people are 1 minute away from certain narratives or beliefs that they have. Say you're someone who believes that the police kill 10,000 unarmed Black men a year in the USA, right? Completely, like, stupidly off, like, off by a magnitude of 1,000.
Yeah.
Right? But say you believe that, and what, like, check it, right? Like, dude, like, it's not hard to verify. Okay, what's the actual number, right? So before I go out there in the street and I start burning people down and I start rioting and fighting and throwing bricks and doing whatever and holding onto this for years and years and years, why don't I actually see? Okay, wait, what's the number, right? Okay, this is what I feel. This is what the media is sort of telling me. But let me just see. You know, and so that's the thing. And there's so many, there's never been more and quicker and easier access to this information, which is why after a certain amount of time, I'm like, okay, well, whether someone is malicious or they're doing something very destructive because they're just, you know.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Ignorant in a way that they don't need to be. The result often ends up being the same thing, right? So sometimes people start splitting hair about, you know, is it malice or is it ignorance or is it? And I'm like, well, it doesn't really matter. If you're burning down a building, you're burning down a building, right? If you're punching people in the street, you're punching
the end
people
results
in the
same.
Yeah. And that excuse of, like, it's like, well, I have access to this information. You have access. Millions of other people have it.
Right.
We all have access to this information. The same device which you're getting the info of all that other stuff from is the same way you can also access all of that. So is it that you just don't want to, or maybe you know that what you're saying is not really true, but you want to keep, I don't know. I'm finding it harder and harder to excuse certain levels of certain levels of ignorance on certain things, because it's especially when it has such real consequences. Like this is not a. There's certain incorrect beliefs or incorrect data or stats that someone may think are true, and it doesn't actually. It has real world impacts because there's certain narratives that are going on out there. I don't know. We saw it in the last couple of years, right? If someone believes that the mortality rate of someone getting C19 is 20%, right? Mm-hmm. If you believe that, that has real consequences because the things that people advocate and the policies and the behaviors and the way even people were treating each other or whatever, I was like, the disproportionality can get very, very extreme, or you're actually trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist, or maybe the problem is over there, but you're trying to solve this thing. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think you nailed it when you said that a lot of the motivation is fear. I would also say it's certainly fear. And I think there's also a kind of faith that goes along with believing some of those statistics, because they can offload responsibility, not to God in this case, but to the collective, whether it's the social media collective, their friend group, MSNBC, NPR, whatever. I mean, that's the thing, is that all of these news sources have been captured by this ideology. They spread this information as if that is the real data. I can still understand some people being totally skewed in their worldview. Understanding it doesn't mean that I'm not fed up with it. It doesn't mean that it's not dangerous and annoying, and I'm also feeling done with it. But but at the same time, I guess the reason to understand is then to equip us to handle it better. Like, what is the best method to change people's minds, to move people in the right direction? And that's really complicated. But I do think an element of it is, I don't need to look that up because I heard it from a reputable source. So I don't need to look that up because whether or not they think this way consciously, I do think that there's an element of faith and fear that goes into just accepting whatever the narrative is, whether it's about COVID-19 or Black Lives Matter or whatever, trans people, whatever it is. They just absorb it, they believe it, they don't need to question it, and they just move on with this, narrow worldview. And that's the frame for how they understand reality and interact with reality. And it does have real world consequences. And some of those people are unreachable. Like, they'll just scream and shout. And those people, as like John McWhorter has talked about in his book, Woke Racism, we just have to accept that those people exist and move on. We just have to move on from them. But then there are people at like lower rungs of the belief whose minds can change. And I think that's important to remember. I think it's important to remember that we shouldn't just write off everyone who espouses some of these beliefs.
For sure. 100%. 100%. I mean, I think where I certainly attribute malice is with, say, the powers that be, right? The media, the corporate media, the politicians, they know the truth. They know that Black people are not being genocided by police, but they'll say it anyway.
Yeah.
Right. Knowing the division that causes, knowing how much it jacks people up, knowing that it makes it more likely people. That's, to me, I'm like, that's 100% malicious to me. Like, if I'm like, there's no way on earth that the president of the United States or some governor or mayor of a state or a city doesn't actually know what some of these statistics are and what the reality is with what it, but they see the political clout in it. And so they just say it anyway. Yeah. That's the part where I'm like, I think it's extraordinarily irresponsible. It's dishonest, firstly. And the thing is, you don't need to, if you truly wanted to solve some of these problems, like, let's take, take the topic of police brutality, like actual police brutality or unjust police killings of citizens, right? If you truly wanted to actually improve the situation, I believe you would tell the truth, right? You'd be honest about the situation. Say, look, here's the stats, here's the data. This is not something that just happens to Black people or just, more like these are the stats. Here's the data. This is what it is. Everyone agrees across the spectrum. There's nobody who's pro police brutality. There's nobody who wants more. You see what I mean? Right. There's actually a lot of things to unite people here. Totally. I've never heard anybody, whether progressive, conservative, left, right, whatever, say, the problem is we need more police brutality. We need, everyone wants that number to come down. But when you start dividing people along it on something they should be united by. When you make it a black and white issue, when you make it about, you know, racism and this and that, and now you've got people screaming at each other about whether you should say Black Lives Matter or All Lives Matter, I'm like, y'all are lost. Right.
Yeah.
Like this you're debating completely the wrong thing. The conversation
right.
should be about, you know, how police interact with community. It should be about standards. It should be about training.
Right.
It should be about like that's where the conversation. Yeah, potentially. Right.
Yeah.
That's what it should be. But instead, it's just these silly little narratives, and people would rather score points than solve the problem. And I see this in so many things. It's like,
right.
are you trying to be helpful and actually get to a solution? Or do you want to just beat the opposite team? Are you just trying to score points and dunk? Or
right.
would you like to resolve the issue? And I very much see a lot of the former. I'm like, look, y'all are not serious about actually trying to prevent these incidents from happening. Because if you were, this is not the conversation and behavior you'd be doing. Right? And it happens again and again and again and again.
Right.
And I'm just like, I've seen this repeat, I don't know, at least 20 times in the past decade. And I'm like, look, man, I kind of shrug my shoulders. And I'm like, man, like that kind of sucks, because this is a solvable problem.
Yeah.
But it won't be solved unless people want to be adults and actually, you know, put the partisanship aside and say, okay, look, like, how do we greatly reduce the chance of these type of situations happening, whether it's a Tyree Nichols or it's a George Floyd or it's a Tony Tempo
right.
or it's a Daniel Shaver or all these other, all the names, right? The ones
right.
people know and the ones people don't know. How do you, some of those situations, it's like that should not happen, right? Like it's awful. You're just like, how on earth are those people police officers? That should not happen. But
sure.
instead it's like, oh, where is you know, was it racism or was it? And it's like, man, it's, like,
yeah.
it's tiring. Even with the Tyree Nichols situation, man, it's so frustrating. It's like a
right.
black man killed by five black police officers,
yeah.
in a mostly black police force. And the conversation is, oh, were they driven by racism? I'm
white
like, stop. Man. Like, it's, you know what? This is what I mean. It's just like,
yeah.
stop, man. This is so
yeah.
silly. Just stop. Like, let's have the real convo.
Right. No, I totally agree. And I think you're right that that's where, for some people, some of that malice comes in, because, you know, you had all these people saying and still saying, abolish the police, abolish the prisons, and you know, some saying defund the police. And then when you try to talk to people about this and say, well, there really are these activists, this abolitionist movement that wants to get rid of the police and even the prisons, that's insane, right? Where they're like, well, that's not what they really mean. What they really mean is diverting resources and giving it to the poor. And you're like, okay, well, you know, some people mean that, sure. But then there are other people who really want to abolish the police. I mean, there are books mm-hmm. written about it. There are articles about it. There are people on camera saying these things. And then when you try to talk to people who are in this liberal space, they give them more credence and say, well, they don't really, I mean, that's crazy, right? They don't really mean that. But they do. I mean,
yeah.
there's a certain percentage of them who really just want to, again, it comes down to, it's so interesting how it comes down to this hatred of capitalism and this love for this idealized vision of socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of what the battle comes down to, which is really interesting when you start reading it a little bit more. And I've, you know, read a lot of Thomas Sowell, and it just becomes clearer and clearer that it's just about that kind of battle between this socialist idealized vision of humanity and the one where we have these constraints that we have to deal with, that we need to you know, restrict our baser impulses and try to live harmoniously and do whatever we can to do that. And you know, it's two different idealized, it's an idealized conception of how we can change humanity for the better, and then we don't need the police then, and you know, everything will just be fine, versus this idea of, well, we all have inherent flaws and we need to just work with them the best that we can.
Yeah.
So it's interesting when you start to see it that way and see how it kind of falls in between those two camps.
Mm. It there's something extraordinarily cynical about it as well, because, you know, number one, so many of the people advocating the abolish the police nonsense, you know, none of those people live in the areas and in the communities that would
right.
be affected by such a thing, right? That's the first part. It's this sort of luxury belief. And then also, if you poll the people who do live in those areas, right?
Right.
Like primarily, you know, more you know, areas with fewer white people, areas that are, you know, more minority heavy per se, those people want more policing. The problem is that their community's not safe. The vast majority of people who live in inner city areas or whatever are not criminals and are law abiding people who just want to have decent schools and have enough to eat and have safe communities. And the truth is, if you think practically, if you want people to genuinely even invest in some of these lower income communities, they have to be safe. First of all, they have to be made safe, because no sane entrepreneur or investor is going to want to build even a shop in a place where they don't even think it's safe to have a shop, because there's people going to be shoplifting or jacking their store or whatever it is. So right. First, the sort of base layer is safety. And yeah, it would be lovely if there were no human sin and we could live in some, you know, right. magical utopia where criminals don't exist. We would all like that. But right. it's just not the reality. There are predatory people out there. And if you remove the checks and the guards against predatory behavior, then you get more predatory behavior. It's not rocket science. Even if someone believed in theory some of these ideas, you can see in practice it doesn't work, because they literally tried it. It's like, okay, let's defund the police and see what happens. And oh, violent crime levels go up, shoplifting goes up, robberies go up. And so, you know, even if someone's in someone's poor line of thinking, they thought it would work. It's like, well, okay, it was tried, it didn't work. So let's move on. I don't know, man. When I hear these abolish the police people, whatever, I'm like, I don't even think they believe it. I don't even believe that they themselves believe it. Because you know, if that person got in trouble or right. were attacked, who's the first person they're going to call?
Of course. Right?
Like, yeah. It's like when you see, it's like when you see even certain politicians, you know, talking about whatever, you know, they're surrounded by armed guards. I saw this video of Gavin Newsom literally, right. you know, dissing the Second Amendment whilst surrounded by at least five armed guards. And he's talking about, you know, how guns are this and this. I'm like, bro, you're surrounded by guns. Right now, if someone ran up on you, they would get shot by one of your armed. So I don't know. Like, I just, it does get frustrating, because it's just like, there are, number one, I am truly, truly grateful and appreciative of how much progress has been made in the past century in, you know, whether you're in the UK or you're in the USA, whatever, compared to 2023, like we're as far as they're concerned, we're already kind of in this utopia.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are a lot of the big problems have been solved. And I think it's important for people to have gratitude for that. But then with the things that still exist, it's like, these are solvable if people want to be mature and, you know, put the emotion to the side, just kind of put the tribalism to the side and come to the table and talk about, you know, maybe, you know, let's take, I don't know, take these five issues and let's talk about them seriously and bring together ideas from different sides of the table. And yeah, let's do the diversity and inclusion thing. Let's actually listen to diverse viewpoints and diverse ideas, and let's hear people's different experiences from different communities and so on. Let's hear from the police officers. Let's hear the police officers' side of the story. Like, you don't think they're scared? Of course they're scared in some of these places, right? That's leading to some of the behavior. There's not a lot of trust between the community and the, you know, and the state agents and so on. So I don't know, man. It's it frustrates me, because I don't think it's whilst I don't know all the solutions, I think I know the process to get to genuine solutions. And I'm just not seeing a lot of it. I think it's wonderful that more people are having these type of conversations and people are doing podcasts and the rise of independent media and all that. Yeah. But I'm like, where are the politicians? Where are the people who actually make the decisions? Where are, like, they're the ones who should be involved in all this, right? Why wasn't, with all these issues, why wasn't Dr. Fauci on Joe Rogan? You know what I mean? Like, why? Yeah. I mean, I know why, but those are the conversations that should all be happening if people are, you know, people really, really want to solve some stuff.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I have another film called When in Doubt that I've been making for quite a while, where I am just bringing people of opposing viewpoints, political or religious or whatever it is, together to talk, to have productive conversations, to see if they can talk through some of these issues, not necessarily to agree, but to understand the other person better, to understand why they believe what they believe, and then to make ideally some progress, at least in understanding, if not, you know, I use the word doubt in the title because to me, doubt is a key. It's a key concept when interacting with people who believe the total opposite of what you do. Because if we're all running around completely convinced of our own beliefs, our own ideologies, our own way of seeing the world, then we're going to miss a lot. And I mean, the only way for us to really get closer to the truth is to talk to people who we disagree with, not necessarily talk to people who are going to just insult us and derail the conversation. That's not useful. But people who are actually willing to have a conversation, who are on the other side, it's extremely vital. That's obviously why free speech is vital. That's why John Stuart Mill said, you know, he who knows only his side of the case knows little of that, because the only way that you can really know your own opinion and really have a good foundation for what you believe is to hear the best opposing argument against it. And we're definitely missing that a lot in society. And I think the more that we can encourage that in the culture, at least my hope is that the more that that will spread out and then influence the way people vote and the way certain politicians want to appeal to people. I mean, you know, it's kind of an idealistic vision that I have of the world, but I think it's necessary to at least try to push for that.
Yeah.
And try to encourage those conversations.
Yeah, I agree totally. I think, beyond the rejection of the concept of personal responsibility, I think a lot of the problems that we're now having, I would say perhaps even that, I think it stems from this sort of permanent adolescence or this sort of infantilization of adults. I think so many problems come from that. I see this, we're in this weird situation where in some ways adults are being treated like children, and then in others, children are being treated like adults. And
right.
It's causing a lot of problems, right? Yeah. So all this over emotionality and people being triggered and, you know, I need a safe space and I can't even have a conversation with someone who did, right? All of that stuff. I'm like, it's really childish to me. Ultimately, it's childish. It's like, if you're an adult, if you're 20 plus, let alone 30 plus, 40 plus years old, you should be able to have a conversation with someone who disagrees with you on certain things without throwing a fit, without insulting them, without resorting to straw manning and being super disingenuous or getting so triggered that you just rage quit or what. I'm like, what happened to stoicism or just self-control? Right. I mean, I hear and see things I disagree with or that I might find offensive even or whatever every day. Right.
Right.
It's part of it. But I'm not here advocating, okay, every single thing that does not perfectly align with my belief system must be destroyed. Anyone who holds that view we can't exist. Or if they do, I can't talk to them or I can't be friends.
They're a Nazi. Yeah.
It's very exhausting. It's also, that's another part of it is it's exhausting. It's not a fun and pleasant way to live. When I see, that's something that struck out actually when I was watching the Woke Reformation is I'm looking at all these activists. I'm like, none of these people are happy.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? I'm like, I'm like, none of these people are happy, successful, grounded, well-rounded emotionally. I'm just like, this is just, it's almost like toddlers in adult bodies just screaming and the chanting and the repeating of phrases. And I'm just looking at it like, this is weird. It's almost like there's a spell that's been cast upon people and they're just behaving in this very, very bizarre, very cultish way. I know some people use, I compare this whole stuff to a religion sometimes, but more accurately, it's like the cultish sect of a religion.
Sure.
In many of these cases, because most religious people are not that are more open-minded and more willing to discuss and defend the beliefs and even question. I mean, I'd say a big part of faith is actually if you're a person of faith of a believe in a traditional religion, no one questions my religious faith more than I do, right? As someone who has I'm a Christian. As someone who has religious beliefs and also is a critical thinker and is a mature, I wrestle with certain things more than anyone else. So if I can wrestle with it and if I'm there, thinking about it from all these different angles,
Right.
Of course I can have a conversation with someone else. And It's also just a degree of humility. You know, there are things that we do not know and we are not 100% sure of. And it's not possible that all 8 billion people in the world are correct about everything, despite the fact, of course, we all think that we're correct. You wouldn't believe what you believe if you didn't think it was correct.
Sure.
But there's just that degree of humility of saying, okay, look, this is what I believe. Here's why I believe it. Here's my line of thinking. I accept that I don't know. I don't know everything, right? I don't know everything. And if people could just accept that, I mean, how are you? How would you even get to a stage where people think you need to, you know, attack or kill the non-believer when you yourself have enough humility to recognize, hey, like I know I'm not right about 100% of everything. Like that's not even possible.
Totally.
So yeah, I think that would fix a lot.
Yeah, I think you said the key words, I don't know. I mean, I think we should normalize that a lot more, you know, whether it's politics or religion or social or beliefs on, you know, social issues, whatever it is, like, yeah, we should be as well informed as we can be. We should read and study and talk to people who disagree, but we should also realize that, like, some things are just really complex, especially with the way that, you know, the news comes through social media and just news in general is so often inaccurate. And we find out later that it was based on lies. And I mean, everyone just about knows this now. So we should be more humble and we should be more willing to say, well, this is what I think at the moment, but I don't really know.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do at times, especially when there's a lot of emotion behind what we're thinking about. If it's a social issue, something that we're passionate about, it can be really challenging to take that stance. And I think that's why more people don't, because it feels good to feel impassioned and, you know, even empowered to take a particular stance on a particular issue and to just drive forward with that issue, which is important. That's important to do. Mm-hmm. It's also important to reflect and to think about how we know what we know and whether or not we really know it. And I think that allowing some doubt in our minds at times, I think is super crucial, because again, that there's just no other way to get closer to the truth. We're always finding out more information, better information. And the only way to do that is to be willing to revise our beliefs, be willing to say, well, I guess I could be wrong about that. Let me update my beliefs now. You know, and that's something that, generally speaking, especially true woke believers are just not interested in entertaining.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
Yeah, I think you're so on point there. I think another part of it as well, and this you really see this on social media, and it's hard to not become a victim to, or to fall into, especially if you're someone with a significant and growing platform, which is that it is much easier to only be attacked or confronted or criticized by the quote unquote other side than your own. Friendly fire hurts a lot more. Friendly fire hurts a lot more, right? So if you're someone who is generally more this way leaning or more that way leaning or whatever, it's a lot easier to just be hard line down the way and to just stick to certain talking points and not ask certain questions or bring up certain positions or support certain positions that you may actually believe in.
Right.
Because, you know, if you're just like a right-wing conservative dude or gal, and, you know, you just align yourself as a Republican or with the Conservative Party in the UK or whatever it may be, you get used to dealing with stuff from the left. Right. You get used to dealing with whatever they're going to criticize. They're going to attack. They're going to come at you, whatever. But then you've got the backing of your tribe. Same with the flip side.
Totally.
Right. If you align yourself like totally with the left and you're, you know, vote blue, no matter who, whatever, you can deal with attacks from the right and Republicans and the criticism, whatever. You're used to that.
Right.
What hurts a lot more is, oh, you quote unquote step out of line with your tribe. And now not only are you being attacked from the usual side, now you're also getting attacked from the people who usually support you and generally agree with you. So I think so many people just want to avoid that at all costs. They're like, I can deal with attacks from one side. I'm not trying to have people all over the aisle gunning at me. That's very uncomfortable. And also in terms of a support base, right? In terms of, especially if you're a pundit or you're someone who somehow has some financial or career stake in some of these positions,
Totally.
It's like, man, that's so dangerous. So I think that ingrains people even further. So there's not really a good incentive to be let's say, individually minded and critically thinking as perhaps you truly are. It's a lot easier to just kind of pick a team, play for that team, attack the other team, and do it with not much nuance. In fact, having nuance might get you punished.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've felt that pull myself, you know, like in my own platforms, I have a lot more, definitely more conservatives that support me and, you know, on Locals and that sort of thing. And those thoughts have entered my head, like, okay, well, should I kind of play to that base more? And I'm thinking, well, no, I mean, I don't think I should. If I'm not being true to myself, then why would I want to put something out there that I don't really believe in or hide some part of myself? I just think that's toxic and unhealthy. It's easier to do. And if, you know, there is a financial incentive, well, if I say this thing, if I really jab the other side, then I'm going to get points. I'm going to actually potentially make money. It's so easy to fall into that trap. And I totally understand, you know, why some people do that. But I think that intellectual integrity and that kind of humility is extremely important. And it's important for me to be as genuine as I can be. You know, and not saying that I haven't sometimes fallen into that trap. I certainly have, but I really try to just be honest about what I think, regardless of where it's going to fall. Yeah. But it's hard. It's much easier to just stick to the tribe, know that they're going to have your back, and you know, much easier.
It is. It really is. But in the long term, actually, I think it's more dangerous because you get boxed in. And if you never, I don't even normally say this publicly, but I quite intentionally make sure that once in a while I upset people who I know are generally in line with me, not in a way that I make something up that I don't really believe and say it, but like, I'll take one of my views, which is not, you know, strictly in line with the thing. I'll say, well, you know, I think this, because I want to cultivate an audience that is genuinely tolerant. And I love the fact that I've actually been able to do this. I can go on Twitter at this point and say pretty much, like, I can say anything. There's no belief I have that I couldn't say publicly. You know, I'll get some pushback. I'll get some criticism, but I'm not going to lose 10,000 followers. Right.
Yeah.
I might lose like 10. Right. Because all those people who are just cannot tolerate a dissenting viewpoint, they've kind of already gone because I annoyed them a while back already. And I think long-term, that's the best way even to, number one, have real integrity, but also it protects you from cancellation. A lot of people get canceled because they play to a certain crowd, especially if you really cater to the woke crowd, you had better not step out of line, man. Like if they catch you one thing, you like the wrong tweet, you follow someone, they don't like, that's how they watch like a hawk. It's crazy.
Right.
And I know musicians in this situation. I know people in different places where they've really sort of played to that crowd. Mm-hmm. And then they're kind of stuck now because they're like, man, dude, I don't even believe some of this stuff. Or actually, you know what? Like, I'm not on board with this thing. But if I say it, or even if I don't say the opposite, I'm going to get people sort of looking at me askew or, you know, not wanting to work with me and this and that. And I don't know. I think in a place where you're supposed to have freedom of speech and freedom of association and genuine liberty, I don't think that's a good way to live it day to day.
Definitely not. No, I think we should normalize that kind of dissent. And I think you're right. I think that there are a lot of people out there that actually do appreciate that nuance and not necessarily playing to one side, and appreciate when someone's just honest and say like, oh, this is my opinion on this issue, and this is my opinion on this issue. Maybe it doesn't fall into the right leaning camp or the left leaning camp or whatever, but this is just how I'm thinking, and I'm doing my best to understand these issues in the best way I can. I do think that there are a lot of people that do appreciate that, and I think it's a matter of just kind of tapping into that audience of other genuine people who are like, oh yeah, maybe I don't agree with this guy entirely, but I still like the general vibe or, you know, the general goals that this person has. And it sounds like you've been able to cultivate that. And I think I have to some degree as well. And it's nice. It's a different kind of tribe, I suppose, but at the same time, it's one that allows for genuine differences of belief and differences of opinion, and allows you to be more yourself. And I think that's definitely the best way forward, because then you're not just speaking into these certain echo chambers that create bubbles and then separate us even further, and don't allow for good communication. So I think that's crucial.
Absolutely. Travis, man, your docuseries is awesome. Have you got more episodes coming?
Thanks. Yeah. So I just released one on woke capitalism called Capitalism Reimagined with Vivek Ramaswamy and Mark Pellegrino, the actor, and a few other people. So that just came out. And then I've got one that I'm working on. I'm doing a lot because I also work for Peter Boghossian, also working on a film. So I've got a lot of projects, but I do have another episode that I'm planning to tackle the trans issue, especially children transitioning, because I just think that's such a, it honestly makes my blood boil a bit. But I'm going to try to do my best to be as even keeled as I can while tackling that issue, and really hearing from parents and different people who've gone through that issue. So that I think is going to be my next one. Okay. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, man. Get the Matt Walsh poker face on that one.
Right.
you need the killer poker face. Cause that's one that, I'm a very, very, very calm dude, but that's one that, that's one that rightfully triggers me. So
yeah, for sure. Yeah. Totally.
Awesome. Travis, congrats on your work. Good luck with everything that you're doing. Where can people find and follow you online?
Thank you, and congrats to you too. I would say Locals, which is thewokereformation.locals.com, and you can check me out on YouTube at Become the Signal.
Awesome. Travis Brown, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.